This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Senator Barack Obama continues to explain last week's comments in San Francisco. He said, quote, "You go into these small towns in Pennsylvania, and like a lot of small towns in the Midwest, the jobs have been gone now for 25 years, and nothing's replaced them. And it's not surprising, then, they get bitter. They cling to guns or religion or antipathy to people who aren't like them or anti-immigrant sentiment or anti-trade sentiment as a way to explain their frustrations." Rivals Hillary Clinton and John McCain both pounced on Obama's remarks as out of touch and elitist, and the Democratic frontrunner is taking heat from many working-class voters as well. And that's a constituency that will be critical in next week's Pennsylvania primary and just slightly less important come November. Blue-collar men, maybe this election's soccer moms. Was he talking about you? Our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the hour, an argument on the opinion page that Washington owes us better e-government. But first, whether you call them working-class, blue-collar, lunch-bucket voters or Reagan Democrats, what's important to them this presidential election? How much damage did Obama do to himself? We begin with Sherry Lincoln. She's the co-director of the Center for Working Class Studies at Youngstown State University and joins us from Youngstown, Ohio. Nice to have you on the program today.
It's nice to be here.
And who do you think Senator Obama was talking about?
Well, I do think he was talking about a lot of the working class across the industrial Northeast and, frankly, all the way around the country. We forget that the working class is not just old industrial workers, but janitors and waitresses and retail workers all over the place. And I think what he had to say reflects what is true for many of them, though not for all.
What about the characteristics of the American working class? Less well-educated? Whiter?
Yes. Certainly, we would define the working class as people who are more likely to work for hourly wages than for a salary. They tend generally to have lower levels of education, though today, unlike, say, 50 years ago, that might mean having an associate's degree. But they also are working in places where they have limited autonomy and power in the workplace, and that's one of the ways that we look at that, and that includes a really huge range of workers. I think it's also worth remembering that today's working class is much more likely to be service workers, which means that they are also likely to be earning less money and have fewer benefits than the working class of 20 and 30, 40 years ago.
And is he right that the people in these small towns he's describing in the Midwest and in places like Pennsylvania, they haven't had those industrial jobs for 25 years now, and a lot of people still stay in those towns?
Yes. Some people have moved on, but even those who have moved on have not necessarily found better jobs. So we find lots of people in the working class who are very angry and very frustrated. They've been struggling economically for a long time, even during periods when the country has seemed to improve economically. And they've also heard a lot of promises from a lot of politicians over the years who said they would make things better. And so they're sometimes suspicious about what they hear. They want somebody who will really come in and make a difference. I think those voters are also aware of a growing gap in wealth in the country, and they have a sense that they're being left behind. And I think it's important to remember that that's true not only for people who might have been displaced from industrial jobs 30 years ago, but also for people who are working in a lot of fairly low-wage working-class jobs today who feel like they're really struggling to get by. And they, too, are angry and frustrated.
And are these the same people who John McCain was talking about when he spoke to voters in Michigan earlier this year and said these jobs are not coming back?
I think so, and I think that's a tough thing for people to hear. I think part of the challenge of what Obama said is that recognizing people's anger doesn't mean that there's not a hope and desire for a better future or a belief that somebody might be able to make a difference. But it's very hard, I think, for people to come to terms with the idea that the prosperity we once had in this country, and especially the prosperity that working people once had, might not be coming back. I think that's a very difficult message, and I think that's part of why people are responding in the ways they are to Obama's statement.
Two things I think were especially controversial about his remarks. One you've addressed already, and that was the word bitter. The other, the idea that these people cling to values like religion and guns and prejudice, anti-trade sentiment to explain away their frustrations.
Yeah, I think that's where the heart of the problem lies. I don't think it was wrong for Obama to recognize people's anger and frustration. Whether you want to term that bitterness is another matter. But I think it's more complicated to explain the voting patterns. We do know that in the 2004 election, for some working class voters, they didn't see a big difference in policy between the Republicans and the Democrats. And that was an election where there were a number of what we would term social issues. So, for example, here in Ohio, there was a bill on the November ballot about putting limits on gay marriage, of outlawing gay marriage in the state.
Constitutional amendment, I think it
was. Right.
Yes.
And that brought a lot of people out to vote because they could see a difference in that. And they weren't seeing sufficient differences in policy. But I think it's important to remember that these are not dumb people. We have an image of the working class as, you know, because they don't have a college education, they're really stupid. And they're not. They're actually very smart, and they analyze what's going on around them in the world. And they're looking at the policies, and they're looking for someone to step up and say, I have a plan to make things better.
And they've been hearing a lot of, again, promises from politicians as the campaign went through Michigan, Ohio, and again in Pennsylvania. So I expect we're going to hear more in the weeks, in the days before the Pennsylvania primary. Sherry Lincoln, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Sherry Lincoln, co-director of the Center for Working Class Studies at Youngstown State University, with us from Youngstown, Ohio, on the phone. With us here in Studio 3A is Rui Teixeira, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, co-author of the report The Decline of the White Working Class and the Rise of a Mass Upper Middle Class. He's kind enough to be with us here. Thanks very much for coming in. Nice to see you again.
Great to be here.
And what are some of the common themes that we see around these working class voters that Sherry Lincoln was talking to us about?
Well, I think Sherry touched on a number of them. I think one critical theme, obviously, for this election is their level of economic discontent and their sense that the economic ground has shifted underneath their feet, and they're sort of wondering where they're going to go in the future, where their kids are going to go. They're sort of where their way of life is going to go. This is a matter of great concern to these voters because the last several years have not been kind to them. But more broadly, you can look back, 35 years and say the last 35 years has not been very kind to them. This has been a period when America, by and large, has grown not as fast as it did, and incomes have not risen as fast as they used to. But it's been particularly bad for these voters. Anyone with less than a four-year college degree has really done rather poorly since about the middle 1970s. So there's a real question in their minds of what America has in store for them in the future. And they're very interested to hear what politicians have to say about it. So far, it hasn't seemed to work out quite so well. And the other side of it is really touched on by the controversy that you're referring to, which is their sense of more cultural traditionalism, their sense that especially the Democrats perhaps seem out of touch with that at times. It seems like they don't respect their way of life. It seems like their social liberalism gets in the way of connecting to these voters and really hearing what they have to say and what their commitments and priorities really are, and a sense of elitism on their part. And that was really what I think Obama's getting slammed on this, in general. And, of course, obviously the McCain and Clinton campaigns had some interest in pushing this, but it did give them an opening to raise this issue and argue that, in fact, not only he is elitist, and if Democrats, if they wish to get away from this, have to adopt it. I think it's a little bit unfair to the remark once you look at it in context, but nevertheless, the perception was there, particularly, I think, the stuff about guns and about religion. I mean, can't you, like, own a gun and go to church and, not be clinging to it because, your economic way of life is deteriorating? Again, I don't think that's what he meant, but that's how it's being interpreted, and that's where the discussion is.
Also here with us in Studio 3A is Raihan Salam, an associate editor at The Atlantic and a fellow at the New America Foundation. He co-authored the book Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. And thank you very much for coming in as well.
Thank you, Neil.
And these values Rui was just talking about, are these the kinds of issues that enabled Republicans, famously Ronald Reagan, to bring these voters into their camp over the past, 35 years?
That's absolutely a big and significant part of the story. But I also think that there is a tighter relationship between cultural traditionalism and economics than people commonly believe.
Go on.
Oh, yeah. Well, basically, when you're looking at the white illegitimacy rate in this country, it's about where the black illegitimacy rate was when Daniel Patrick Moynihan sounded the alarm several decades ago. Now, when you're looking at who are these single mothers who are having kids and are having a tough time economically speaking, they don't come from upper middle class families. They don't come from, kind of, solidly middle-class families. They come from working-class families, oftentimes, you know, from rural areas, smaller metropolitan areas. And these are voters who really do care about the survival and success of marriage. This is not an issue of demonizing a different group. This is, for them, something about the turmoil that they see in their own lives. And so, you know, I think that is there some relationship between that and social conservatism? I think that there probably is. So I think that, you know, the problem is when people are dismissive of this kind of concern as though it has nothing to do with the economic realities that, you know, the working class faces.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation as well. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And Nan is on the line with us from La Crosse in Wisconsin.
Hello. Thank you. I totally agree with the person who just spoke about the white illegitimacy issue, but I also wanted to get to the point where I grew up in a small rural Iowa, and I learned that to get anywhere in life, I had to move away, and I went to college and developed skills, et cetera, and have had several successful careers. But members within my family and friends who I know wouldn't adapt to the changing culture, blaming it all on, you know, big government and all this kind of stuff. And they tended to concentrate more on the social issues that they felt they had more control over, you know, the gun-hunting and gun-loving NRA types, and basically would vote against their own economic interests, you know, believing that, oh, they still had a shot at getting rich, et cetera, and they wanted those tax breaks or that opportunity for advancement that the Republicans, so-called, lead people to believe.
So you might agree with that comment about people being bitter?
Yes, very much so. And I believe that McCain said it as well, but he didn't use the word bitter. McCain had the same, you know, truth. Both of the candidates spoke the truth in Michigan and in Pennsylvania. It's just whether or not, you know, the word bitter tends to be what's sticking in everybody's craw.
Nan, thanks very much. Appreciate it. We're going to take more calls and discuss the idea of people voting for or against their economic interests when we come back from a break. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Again, the email address, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Senators Hillary Clinton, John McCain, and Barack Obama are still battling about remarks that Senator Obama made about working-class voters a week ago, specifically that they're bitter about economic issues. And we've been talking about who makes up that voting bloc and what politicians on the left and right can do to woo them. Rui Teixeira is with us. He's a senior fellow at the Center for New American Progress. And our other guest is Raihan Salam, who's an associate editor at The Atlantic and co-author of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Rui Teixeira, there was a caller just a moment ago talking about I think genetic Democrats in small-town America end up voting conservative or voting Republican against their economic interests, is how she put it, which is certainly how a lot of Democrats have put it over the past 25, 35 years. Nevertheless, they lose a lot of those votes every single time.
Yeah, and as she was alluding to, and Raihan was as well, I mean, a part of the dynamic that makes that happen is a sort of class divide on some of these cultural issues, which also has an economic dimension. People who are doing well are now much more likely to be able to successfully form a family and keep that intact and have children and raise them well. I mean, if you look since the 1970s, it's been in this emerging class divide in divorce rates. If you've got a four-year college degree or more, you're much less likely to get divorced than people who are below you on the economic spectrum. So it's not only that the people who are doing well have the money, but now it's like they've got the families, too, and they're able to keep them intact. And I think that leads to a little bit of, well, dare I say it, bitterness. And I think that's That whole, I think every part of what Obama raised in its most salient points are actually in some ways unobjectionable, at least should be an important part of what we're debating. People have a right, in a sense, and many of them are bitter and discontented because of the way things have evolved economically.
Though he might have found a better way to phrase
it. He might have found
a better
way of putting
it. Religion.
And the idea that people would perhaps respond emotionally in some other areas because they're discontented about their economic situation, but they don't think there's anything they can do about it because nobody really seems on point. I think that also is not a crazy idea. In fact, let me just read something here from Jim Webb, sort of an apostle, as it were, of the white working class. Certainly that's how he styles him. He said in 2006, the politics of the Karl Rove era were designed to distract and divide the very people who would ordinarily be rebelling against the deterioration of their way of life. Working Americans have been repeatedly seduced at the polls by emotional issues such as the predictable mantra of God, guns, gays, abortion, and the flag, while the way of life shifted ineluctably beneath their feet. Does that sound a little bit familiar? But I don't hear anyone accusing Jim Webb of being a, bizarre, Washington-centered, Chardonnay-drinking elitist. But and I think that just illustrates that these ideas have been part of the debate for a while, and they'll continue to be a part of the debate. And they're not raising them is not a sign that you're, sort of sitting on the back deck of your beautiful home and sipping your delightful glass of wine while you ponder the problems of those beneath you.
Let's get another caller in on the conversation. Mary's with us from Sacramento.
Hi. I just want to say that I absolutely agree with your guest last comments regarding Mr. Webb. And I think that, being a lunch bucket person myself, that something that is never brought into the conversation or rarely brought into the conversation is that politics are a luxury. When you're worrying about how to pay your rent or how you're going to pay your bills or buy a new pair of shoes for your little one, thinking about politics and on the grand scale really is a luxury. And what Obama was talking about is precisely true. And people do tend to vote against their personal interests precisely because of that. They reach for something that they are familiar with, that they do have control over, which are guns and religion.
Raihan Salam, are people voting against their economic interests?
Well, that's really thorny. Think about it this way. There was a time when the vast majority of Americans had the kind of views that Senator Obama is describing, on guns, on marriage, on abortion, on a whole host of issues. And the number of people who believe those things has declined. It's dwindled to, let's say about a third of the country, say 40% of the country. And the thing is, as that number declines, it goes from being uncontroversial and something that doesn't make sense to talk about in politics to something that is controversial and that can help you mobilize a political coalition. So, for example, when a much bigger chunk of the workforce was unionized, we talked about the issues that the unions wanted us to talk about because that was an effective way of getting out the vote and mobilizing a coalition. So really, the nature of the economy has changed, and I wouldn't say that it's some... Now, as to economic interests, well, I think this is actually kind of dangerous thing for Democrats to talk about because when you're looking at these white Southern men, when their incomes go above, say, $30,000, they actually start becoming really, really tax sensitive. Why? Well, how many transfers are they getting? Is it really a bidding war for voters? Is it really, I'm getting more from Senator Obama. He's promising me more versus this. That's why I actually think Democrats are smart to talk about aspirations and opportunity more than they are. And this is a theme that Rui has talked about a lot. Mm-hmm. Republicans, in contrast, have always used that language of opportunity and aspiration. There's this idea that, they're all about the rich, et cetera, but really they're all about becoming rich. They're really all about being sure that those opportunities exist to climb the ladder. And there are a lot of non-college educated voters, people who identify as working class, who are paid not a salary, but rather are paid other forms of compensation, a piece rate, say, or a commission. And some of those folks who have intact families, they've found ways to get ahead, and it shapes their political sensibility.
Mary, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's go now to, this is Jameson. Jameson with us from Silverton in Oregon.
Thank you. I have a couple of points to make. Obama's remarks don't really facilitate communication besides the different sides of the political spectrum here. I am one who clings to religion, and I also believe in gun rights, but I've heard many liberals, like Obama, do psychotherapy on me and say, well, it's economic issues or it's, the way you were, you grew up wrong or something, and disregarding the fact that there's a huge historical, intellectual, philosophical basis For instance, the founders of this country arguing for the value of religion in upholding the health of a nation. You know, I mean, and that only goes back a couple hundred years. And they were the ones who put the Second Amendment in there. So really, that increases the divide between the liberals and the conservatives over the value of these cultural issues, and it doesn't facilitate the communication.
Mm. Go ahead, Jameson. I'm sorry.
Further on that point, one of your speakers just said a moment ago that we often will vote against our own economic interests. And again, I want to say, you know, if conservatives were deceived by the Bush administration, conservatives deceived and tricked by the neocons, that may be the case. But I think part of the way that we as a nation are vulnerable to that sort of manipulation is because liberals and conservatives throw darts at each other instead of communicating and psychoanalyze instead of communicating and dialoguing.
And I think I'm hearing a suggestion. I don't mean to put words in your mouth, Jameson, but you feel talked down to?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And I know conservatives can do it to liberals, too. It goes both ways.
Oh, absolutely. Rui Teixeira?
Yeah, well, I think the caller makes some good points, and I think this is precisely why raising this issue does present some difficulties for Obama and his main campaign themes. Again, we could argue about the fairness of it all, but this is politics. You know, this is a guy who's been running on trying to bring people together, trying to get people from different walks of life, different cultural viewpoints, different classes, different races to transcend all that and, you know, sort of come together to make America a better place. And this is, the caller points out, doesn't really facilitate that. And again, I don't think that's really where Obama's coming from, but that's a perception. And it sort of connects to an image of the Democrats, which does have some truth to it, which is that they can come perilously close at times to saying, well, the only reason anyone would vote for the other side is because of false consciousness in a way. They're voting against their economic interests because they've had, you know, dust sprinkled in their eyes by the nefarious Republicans trying to amp them up in these emotional issues. And that there's two problems with that. One is that a lot of these emotional issues are important to people and they're part of their lives. And absolutely, nothing wrong with religion. A lot of people want to have a gun to use it for hunting and so on. And Democrats have frequently asked, like, how could anyone possibly take that stuff seriously? That's obviously not what you want to say. And it's not, you know, I think even true. So that's bad. And then the other side of it is, well, how clear is it that their economic self-interest lies in voting for the Democrats? What if the Democrats haven't had anything particularly useful to say about this in many ways over a number of years? Certainly that was, I think, less true. It's less true today than it was 20 years ago or 10 years ago. But the image lingers. I mean, these are tough problems trying to deal with a globalized economy with increased inequality and so on. And how do you rectify those problems? I think people want to hear some perhaps better and clearer situations for the Democrats. And, you know, obviously the Democrats have gotten beyond just taxing and spending and throwing money at problems. But and that's good. I think the American people say, great, I'm glad you've gotten there. But OK, now what? Where are we going? And I think that's why, you know, the Democrats have to make the case that it's in your economic self-interest to vote.
I think you've made some very good points. I want to also point out that you seem to be buying into the same thing when you say that gun rights or religion is an emotional issue.
Well, you don't think it's emotional? I mean, it has aspects of emotion to it.
It's not just emotional.
No, I'm not saying it's just emotional, but I'm saying it's emotionally freighted. I mean, I think that's not unreasonable.
Mm. Let me ask you, and thanks very much, Jameson. And let me ask you, Raihan Salam, is this an aspect of why people have been wondering? Obama seems to get the endorsements of a lot of unions. A lot of union voters, however, seem to be voting for Senator Clinton.
Well, it's complicated. Even if you look at the unions are split between lots of different types of people, and there are different types of people have different types of conversations. What Obama said in San Francisco to this group of fundraisers is something that's actually very widely believed by a large group of, you know, kind of smart liberals. And I think that Obama really is trying to reach out to new constituencies and actually trying to build bridges. The trouble is he has to shift between lots of different types of conversation. Now, it's easy to criticize him saying that he's being dishonest, something like that, but really it's a matter of shifting emphases, and it's rare that one conversation is heard by this other group. And I think that that's the thing about, you know, when we're the kind of media environment we're in right now, Jimmy Carter, for example, was defending the ethnic purity of neighborhoods when he was in the South in his 1976 presidential campaign. But when he was, you know, with urban liberals in the North, was he going to say the same thing? Of course not. And again, was there a case for what? Maybe there was.
Wasn't an internet in those days.
Exactly. And so I think that, you know, he certainly didn't mean to offend anyone. He certainly didn't mean to condescend to anyone. But, I mean, I think it's actually a pretty good thing that we're raising questions about, you know, the kind of conversation that he's having, because maybe actually it should be more open. Maybe there should be a single conversation. If we're going to bring the country together as Obama intends to bring the country together, it's important that these claims be subject to scrutiny.
Raihan Salam, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution and an expert on political demography and geography. Also with us is, that's Rui Teixeira. I'm reading the wrong line.
Raihan, you've been working behind your back on this stuff.
Didn't you run into each other in the elevator? We'll talk about elevators later in the show. Rui Teixeira, visiting fellow at Brookings and expert on political demography and geography. And also with us, Raihan Salam, an associate editor at The Atlantic and co-author of The Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And let's go now to James. James with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, guys.
Go ahead, please.
Just like I told the lady earlier, 4 months ago, I would have voted for Obama. But it's like one of the earlier callers was commenting, I'm feeling so talked down to right now. I'm really starting to wonder what kind of agenda this guy has in his closet for people in my position.
And, again, I don't mean to put words in anybody's mouth, but are you watching Barack Obama sort of morph into John Kerry here?
Oh, I don't know about John Kerry. I'm thinking more, you know, put a sheet over his head and change up the dialogue a little bit. David Duke.
Really?
Some of the stuff that's coming out of his mouth, if he were a Caucasian male, would be considered so racist that it's just unbelievable. If I made a comment that said the typical African American, I'm immediately jumped on and inspected for my belief on racism.
Yeah, it's the stereotype you're talking about.
Yeah, it's like it's ridiculous, and now I'm supposed to be ignorant because I fall into a certain economic group.
Okay.
What's he got planned for my income level?
All good questions, James. Thanks very much for the call.
Have a good day.
And what James raises is a question I guess we have to focus on. How much damage do you think that Senator Obama may have done to himself with these ill-considered remarks? What do you think, Ryan Salam?
Well, here's the real danger. If he's saying that anti-trade sentiments, for example, are motivated by these base beliefs, these beliefs that he implies that he doesn't really share, well, what does that say about his trade agenda and his criticisms of NAFTA and other programs? I am sure that he means very well. But when you're looking, for example, at his economic advisor, Austin Goolsbee, raising some questions as well about whether or not he's totally serious about this stuff, I think it's a legitimate question.
Meetings with Canadians.
Exactly. Yeah. In Canada, saying that, you know, oh, don't mind his NAFTA rhetoric.
That's just the Ohio primary.
Exactly.
And Rui Teixeira, what do you think? Has he damaged himself?
Well, I mean, I'm uninclined to think this is going to be a big problem over the long haul for him. This is your classic mountain out of a molehill that's pretty dependent on the dynamic of the campaign we're currently in, specifically going up to the Pennsylvania primary. You know, the media likes a story that reflects, you know, themes that have already been raised about the candidate. And you have McCain and Hillary, the other two big political actors here piling on. So I think it was bound to be talked about. I think that, time to some extent will take it away. Plus, I think, you know, he's doing a very important thing, which he's firing back. The big mistake that John Kerry made at times is he didn't fire back. He's trying to have a debate about, well, what was this really about? That, you know, basically apologize for not putting it right, but, you know, trying to actually aggressively assert there's actually some there.
Nevertheless, on the defensive in the debate.
Bound to be defensive for a while, but, you know, the way you get out of being defensive is to some extent to take the offense and, you know, say, who does Hillary Clinton think she is, Annie Oakley, and I don't see her out there in the duck blind firing at those little birdies every Sunday. So I think that's, you know, that's going to be effective, too, to some extent. But I think the campaign will pass it by. The concept that having alluded to the things he alluded to at this fundraiser is somehow going to sink his chances of being president of the United States and the current political environment where the incumbent president has a 28% approval rating, the economy's in recession, and we have an unpopular rule. I frankly, it strikes me as ludicrous. Hmm. But that won't stop us from talking about it.
Well, I see your point, but you know, if you look at France, you had Nicolas Sarkozy, a member of a profoundly unpopular political party, the same party as a profoundly unpopular president. Then you had a different guy, a guy who changed the tone, a guy who had a different sensibility. And I think the thing is Obama a snob? I doubt it. I think he really cares about working class voters. But the trouble is, you know, there's this way in which people get the sense maybe we don't deserve Barack Obama. Maybe Barack Obama is a saintly figure who really is trying to rise above petty politics. He has a kind of analytical frame. He is a different kind of politician. But maybe, you know, the kind of politicians we want are people like Hillary Clinton and McCain. Maybe that reflects poorly on us as a people. But
Raihan Salam and Rui Teixeira, we're going to continue this conversation in just a couple of minutes after a short break. We'll also go to the opinion page and discuss e-government and why the only page that really works on the government website is the one where they want you to pay your taxes. Somehow the communication doesn't go the other way. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're talking with Rui Teixeira of the Brookings Institution and a senior fellow at the Center for New American Progress and the Century Foundation, and also with Raihan Salam, an associate editor at The Atlantic and co-author of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream, about the significance of remarks made last week in San Francisco to fundraisers by Senator Barack Obama. Here's an email we have from Russ in San Francisco. I grew up working class on the south side of Chicago. I'm the first in my family to get a college degree. It's interesting how your guests talk so much about they. The working class often do feel like a subspecies in the eye of the media. I can affirm that many of my working class friends and family are less well-educated, less well-informed, and more racially prejudiced than my working colleagues, but they are not stupid, and they know when they're being talked down to. The trouble with Obama, whom I still strongly support, is that he puts on a working class tone in his speeches and talks another way in private to San Francisco donors. And Rui Teixeira, I guess that's something that you should always be aware that anything you say when you're a presidential candidate is recorded and will get out.
Right. I think if Barack Obama had any doubt about that, he should get rid of that doubt now. I mean, there's no sanctuary. There's no safety. You know, you probably shouldn't even whisper it to someone who's, you know, close to you in a crowd. You should just, you know, always think that somehow it'll get out there in the Internet and you might have to explain it. I mean, look, the Huffington Post, where this originally came out, is a liberal, Democratic-oriented site. So, you know, you got no friends, really, in this game when it comes to stuff that gets out in the Internet and in the news. So, yeah, they need to do that. And again, I mean, this caller is really bringing out this fundamental problem about how does what he says, the perception of what he says, and the debate about what he says fit into an already existing narrative, which is that, you know, maybe this guy is kind of looking down on us. Maybe he's kind of elitist. And I think, you know, the good that can come out of this for the Obama campaign, as I said, he is fighting back about this, which I think is good, is it sensitizes them even more than perhaps they already were to the need to address this issue, the need to be able to connect to these voters, to be authentic, to never appear like you're talking down to them. And I think perhaps the message has been received. We'll see.
Let's go to Becky. Becky with us from Binghamton in New York.
Hi. I'd like to just mention that, you know, when we talk about the working class, and I'm one of these people who has a college education, have a bachelor's degree in education, and also graduate credits, and yet I'm out punching a time clock every day because that's the opportunity that's available to us. So it's not that the working class necessarily is uneducated, it's just that's where we work.
Mm-hmm. Does she have a point, do you think, Raihan Salam?
Well, it's definitely. I mean, I think that, you know, there are a lot of overlapping definitions, and this is a very hard thing to define well. And, you know, whichever way you slice it, you're going to get different results. But I think that, you know, just as Sherry Lincoln was pointing out earlier on, we have a couple of ideas for things that are broadly characteristic of this group, and that's what we try to use.
Mm-hmm. Becky, thanks very much for the call.
Yep.
See you. And Raihan Salam, thank you for your time today.
Thank you
very much for coming in. Also, our thanks to Rui Teixeira. Both of them joined us here in Studio 3A. We'll see you next time, Rui.
Great to be here.
And coming up on the opinion page, e-government, why we need more.